KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
Good morning. The tariff war is on pause for 90 days for most countries. President Trump reversed course after days of global chaos. We hear how U.S. companies are dealing with the remaining tariffs on Morning Edition from NPR News. Markets in Asia rose today after Trump paused most tariffs. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. A former diplomat from Singapore talks of the pros of open markets and what a shift in U.S. trade policy signifies. Netflix's sci-fi series Black Mirror is back with a new season. We delve into the show's tech-focused storylines, including adapting to an AI-led world. It is Thursday, April 10th. Happy birthday to Q-Tip, the rapper-producer with A Tribe Called Quest, is 55 years old today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The European Union says it will match President Trump and pause its pending tariffs against U.S. products for 90 days. Trump suspended some of his new tariffs yesterday, but he increased U.S. tariffs on China to 125%. China says it is open to negotiation, but NPR's John Ruich reports China says the U.S. first needs to change its attitude.
China's Commerce Ministry spokeswoman He Yongchuan says the door for talks is open. But pressure and threats are not the right way to deal with China, she says. Dialogue must be conducted on an equal footing and on the basis of mutual respect. Beijing and Washington have been locked in a spiraling tariff war with each side blaming the other and no end in sight. Trump has said China wants to make a deal but hasn't given him a call yet to get the ball rolling. Despite openness to talks, China's foreign ministry spokesman Lin Jian says Beijing is prepared to continue to take resolute countermeasures to safeguard its rights and interests. John Ruich, NPR News, Beijing.
The suspension of tariffs is bringing some relief to small business owners. NPR's Windsor Johnston spoke to an entrepreneur in western North Carolina struggling to rebuild after Hurricane Helene.
Jessie Dean is the owner of the Asheville Tea Company. She says the on-again, off-again threat of tariffs is making it that much harder to rebuild her business from the ground up.
Coming off the back of losing our entire facility during Hurricane Helene makes this particularly challenging because we are trying to replace lost equipment that was washed down the river. We already had debt because of COVID.
The Trump administration says the use of tariffs will lead to a stronger trade relationship between the U.S. and international powers. However, the duties could force small business owners to either absorb the price hikes, pass them on to consumers, or risk going under. Windsor Johnston, NPR News.
President Trump has signed two executive orders that target private Americans. They're aimed at two men who worked during his first term in the White House. Trump is stripping their security clearances and ordering an investigation into their conduct while federal employees. One is former Homeland Security official Miles Taylor. He criticized Trump in an anonymous op-ed article and later publicly in a book. NPR's Ashley Lopez reports the other targeted person is former cybersecurity official Christopher Krebs.
For folks who don't remember this, right after the 2020 election, Krebs, who, by the way, has described himself as a lifelong Republican and he had been appointed by Trump, basically refuted Trump's big lie about the election being stolen. As you can imagine, Trump didn't like that. He fired Krebs at the time, and now he's ordering the Attorney General, the Director of National Intelligence, and other agency leaders to immediately suspend any active security clearances held by him and entities associated with him.
NPR's Ashley Lopez reporting. You're listening to NPR. The Senate has confirmed two of President Trump's choices. Senators have confirmed Paul Atkins as the nation's top Wall Street regulator. He will lead the Securities and Exchange Commission. The Senate also confirmed former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee to be the next U.S. ambassador to Israel. The maker of ChatGPT, OpenAI, is countersuing billionaire Elon Musk. OpenAI claims Musk has engaged in a pattern of harassment. As NPR's Bobby Allen reports, Musk first filed a lawsuit against OpenAI, claiming that it put profits over the public good.
Lawyers for OpenAI are asking a federal judge to stop Musk's attacks against the leading AI firm, saying he has made it his project to take down OpenAI. The bitter feud between Musk and OpenAI has been long running. Musk was a co-founder of OpenAI, but split away from the company before it unveiled ChatGPT in late 2022. Musk has since launched a competing firm called xAI. In recent months, Musk has sued OpenAI, saying it abandoned its nonprofit mission and misled early investors. And in February, Musk submitted an unsolicited bid to take over OpenAI, which the company dismissed as an unserious publicity grab. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
There are flood warnings up in several states today, from Ohio to the Gulf Coast. This follows several days of storms that began a week ago. Now, the exceptionally heavy rain that followed has surged into rivers, pushing them to major flood stage. Officials in Cincinnati say the Ohio River crested there yesterday at levels not seen in decades. Parts of downtown Cincinnati are flooded. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Coming up, the Trump administration's back and forth on tariffs has roiled markets, and customers are paying the price. In a few minutes, we'll speak with the CEO of a major grocery chain about how he's responding.
But first, the European Union is pausing its retaliatory tariffs on the U.S. after some dramatic turns in President Trump's trade policy on Wednesday.
Early in the morning, his steep new tariffs went into effect. Then he told Americans to, quote, be cool as markets plunged. But by afternoon, he backed off and put a 90-day pause on most of the tariffs. Markets soared.
Everybody wants to make a deal, actually. And, you know, we want to do what's right for our country. We also want to do what's right for the world.
NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez was there. He joins us now. Good morning, Franco.
Good morning, Leila.
So you were at the White House yesterday in the Oval Office. Tell us about this really big day.
Yeah, it was a really big day. I mean, for weeks, his team had insisted that Trump was going to hold the line. And just days ago, Trump even wrote on social media in all capital letters, "My policies will never change." And then they did in another social media post. And this is how Trump explained it at the White House.
Well, I thought that people were jumping a little bit out of line. They were getting yippy, you know, they were getting a little bit yippy, a little bit afraid.
You know, he also talked about concerns in the bond market, and then he downplayed all those concerns. And Trump and his aides began painting this as being part of their strategy all along.
So how much of this had to do with the markets? Is this an about face?
You know, there's no mistaking the turmoil that the markets were under, and it was getting worse and worse. Top investors were pleading with Trump. Some were almost begging him to do this very thing, issue a 90-day pause. Now, Trump did say you have to be flexible in your policies, but he insisted this was the right thing to do.
Okay, so what happens now? There's a 90-day pause, and then what?
Yeah. I mean, we should be clear that the administration is keeping a baseline 10% tariff on imports, okay, which is a big deal. But it is nothing, nothing like what he was threatening, such as a 46% tariff against Vietnam. Well, so now they've begun these discussions with these countries on what they've described as tailor-made negotiations for each, though we don't really know what that involves. But, you know, his goals on this have always been kind of unclear. They've talked about the tariffs being about reducing the trade deficit. They've talked about the tariffs being about bringing back manufacturing. They've talked about the tariffs being about boosting government revenues. So it's always kind of been this mixed bag.
Right. And then to be clear, the president has spent a lot of time talking about China's trade practices. And again, those tariffs are still there on China. So how does this shift affect the country?
Yeah, another really big deal. I mean, while he paused the tariffs on most everyone else, he doubled down on China, raising the tariffs to 125%. He said it was punishment when China announced their own retaliatory tariffs. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said China made a mistake and was basically being isolated as a result.
You might even say that he goaded China into a bad position. They responded, they have shown themselves to the world to be the bad actors.
Now, Trump said he did not think he would need to raise the China tariffs any further. And even though he had some very harsh words about China's trade abuses, he actually called Xi Jinping a friend and said he expects Xi to eventually call. And then he says they'll work out a deal. So all of that is something we'll be watching for.
That's White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Thank you, Franco.
Thank you, Layla.
Now let's turn to the impact of tariffs on your food bill. And for that, we're going to head to Stu Leonard's. If you buy groceries in New York, New Jersey, or Connecticut, you probably know the chain. It's still family-owned, and it shows. There are costumed characters in the aisles, a few petting zoos, and even dancing vegetables.
We're avocados, we're avocados. We have a song to sing for you.
Okay, so those aren't really vegetables, they're animatronics. But anyway, like every other grocery store in the U.S., Stu Leonard's is trying to figure out how to manage these huge shifts. So we've called CEO Stu Leonard Jr. to ask how he's dealing with these ups and downs, and he's with us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Michelle. How are you today?
Better now that I'm talking to you.
Okay. Good, thank
you. There are thousands of items in any grocery store, but can you give us a sense of what percentage of what's on the shelves is subject to tariffs?
Well, right now, what we're mainly focused on actually is all of the wine and the spirits. And a lot of those importers that bring these products in are small businesses. So the food part of it, we get 1 million pounds of salmon from Canada every year. But that's, since it's a fresh product, is not tariffed right now. And then Mexico, the big item I worry about down there are basically avocados and tequila, because you can't buy them anywhere else in the world. California does some avocados too, but not enough to supply the needs that you have. So mainly the products that are keeping me awake at night are you know, the tequila, the avocados. We get our New Zealand lamb, we got Easter, and these are small farmers that we deal with, you know?
Yeah, so what are those conversations like? Have you had to raise prices? Have they raised prices? What's going on there?
I'm on the phone sometimes twice a day with a lot of our farmers and ranchers. You know, basically, they're feeling just overall financial pressure at their farms right now. But, you know, if they get hit with a 10 or 20% tariff, you know, these are families. They don't run these big companies. So usually what we do, and we did it during COVID, was when we needed product and they told us that the prices had gone up, we usually worked it out where we split it with them.
You split it.
Okay. So Stu Leonard's eats half of it and they eat half of it. And most of them are happy with that.
Have these tariffs caused you to feel you had to raise prices on anything in particular so far?
Well, the good news is just about all our suppliers are doing a wait and see right now. In the food business, I know we're like a bullseye right now, the food industry, as far as inflation and so forth. But you know what? Right now, you need volume in the food business. We don't want to see sales go down. If we raise prices, sales go down unless you're Gucci or Prada or something. I don't know what'll happen by dinner time today. But, you know, that's important to us right now.
So go back to what's keeping you up at night, right? You said it's the avocados, it's the tequila, it's the sort of the lamb. I think some people might say, okay, you know, tequila's not an essential. Avocados, kind of, maybe. Well, so if people don't buy it, then is that really a big deal? If there's achieved some long-term goal of kind of reorienting the economy toward, say, something advantaging American businesses, American vendors more so?
Well, I would say just about every product you can buy from Europe, and we don't buy much from China, and this is only affecting less than 5% of our business right now. So we're mainly fresh and perishable. But you can buy a lot of these products in the U.S. Brie cheese, for instance, a beautiful 70% or a full cream you get from France. The same family has moved over to Wisconsin and is producing Brie. And it's $2 a pound less. So, okay, there's great European wine, chateaus and all that stuff. But California, is amazing. Washington State, I think people are going to start buying more U.S. wines.
All right. We have to leave it there for now, Mr. Leonard. That's Stu Leonard Jr. He's the CEO of the supermarket chain, Stu Leonard's. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Michelle, it was a pleasure. Have a nice day.
In a win for the White House, a federal appeals court has paved the way for the administration to once again fire probationary federal workers who had just been reinstated. It's the latest jolt for employees at scores of different federal agencies. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
Tens of thousands of federal workers were suddenly fired right after President Trump took office. They had what's called probationary status because they were hired recently or they just got promoted. Two different lawsuits alleged, though, that the firings were illegal, and two federal judges both ordered that the workers be rehired as the cases move forward. The government did hire back thousands of workers, but this week, those judges' orders were both paused, one by the Supreme Court, the other by an appeals court in Maryland, apparently clearing the way for the administration to fire the workers all over again if it chooses to.
This is pandemonium, and it's obviously causing a lot of confusion.
Michelle Berkovich is an employment attorney who's been working on other legal efforts to help probationary workers. She says she's been hearing from some of them over the past couple of days.
Folks are just at a loss. This is unfortunately not going to be the quick solution that we were hoping to see.
The Trump administration has framed the mass firings of federal workers as part of an effort to target inefficiency, waste, fraud, and abuse. The president last month, after a cabinet meeting, spoke about his administration's efforts, as he put it, cutting a lot of people.
Many didn't come to work. Many had no intention of coming to work. Many were paid and working someplace else. There were lots of bad scenarios, but they're being weeded out.
Berkovich says for probationary workers, that is just not true.
That is absolutely not true. I can say I've looked at a database of about 10,000 employees, probationary employees terminated. Most of them had glowing reviews whose supervisors are profusely apologizing for being forced to fire them despite their great work.
One of the lawsuits was filed in California. It alleges, among other things, that the government lied to thousands of workers about why they were being fired. The judge at a hearing at one point said, quote, "It is a sad day when our government would fire some good employee and say it was based on performance when they know good and well that that is a lie." The government maintains that the firings were proper. Berkovich notes that despite this setback for workers, both of these lawsuits will keep moving ahead.
The two cases are ongoing. They are not dead in the water by any means.
Still, she's telling workers if they find another good job, they should probably take it. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
This is NPR News. Thank you.
of the next fresh air. Journalist Gardner Harris talks about his book, Investigating Johnson & Johnson. Last month, the company lost a bid to settle lawsuits that claimed its talc powder products, including baby powder, caused cancer. Johnson & Johnson faces tens of thousands of claims. Harris's book is called No More Tears. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens selected for home landscapes. More at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. In a world where we become more and more reliant on technology, Black Mirror shows us just how vulnerable we might be. Black Mirror is a hit sci-fi series on Netflix of short stories exploring our relationship with tech and what could happen if things go off the rails. I spoke with Charlie Brooker, the show's creator, about the latest season out today. It kicks off with an episode about the degradation of tech services over time.
Rashida Jones plays a regular woman who, there's a medical emergency and her husband signs her up to a service that cloud stream part of her brain. But the problem is it comes with a subscription tier and she starts sort of spouting adverts.
Families that stay together bask in the glow of Christ's heart. For more information on faith-based family counseling, visit christsheart.com.
Okay.
There's another episode about the gaslighting of a rival at work.
But coming at it from a slightly sort of tech perspective.
What I don't understand is how she changed the f***ing email. Like, how?
No, but she didn't.
Okay, I know what I wrote.
And I think we're sort of living in a time when we're all sort of being a bit gaslit.
In another episode, actor Paul Giamatti investigates what went wrong with an old romance. He uses technology that allows him to actually enter old photographs.
That's the day I met Carol. This would have been in Brooklyn.
We can enhance the moment by entering the image. Shall we go in?
What do you mean, go in?
It's easiest to just show you.
I mean, is that something that you've heard is a few years away, 10 years away, or 20 years away? Is that something you've heard about?
I would imagine that's probably 5 minutes away in some form. I mean, maybe not to the degree of sophistication that we show it unfolding in the actual episode itself, but certainly I think the speed with which these things evolve. I think we've all seen videos where somebody, you know, feeds a Van Gogh self-portrait to an AI and presses a button and then you've got a sort of animated video of him rapping or whatever. So the notion that you could sort of walk inside some kind of VR recreation of an old photograph, I suspect is really very much not far away.
Yeah. And that episode that you mentioned with Rashida Jones, where she is basically part of this tiered system of operating, right? In some, it's like, I think we all live in tiers, right? In every single thing that we subscribe to, there's always something better or something worse. You either have an ad-free experience or you don't. And that ad-free experience is supposed to be better than the one that has the ads.
Yes, but it's weird. You're right. The tier system, I mean, especially being British, you can't help being British growing up, you're acutely aware of the class system. And it's just, we've sort of got this new version of it constantly, where everything, there's a sort of the premium version, the standard version, and the kind of rubbish version of everything.
Right, because I think the feeling is that if you're in the lower tier, you're not having as good of an experience. But then all of a sudden, how high do the tiers go? I mean, it's infinite, right? The sky is infinite.
I was flown to the USA, and as I got on the plane, I got randomly upgraded. Like, I'd never been in business class before, and I was marveling at, like, oh my God, I've got a big screen here, and I've got proper cutlery, and wow, they've brought out a tablecloth. On the flight back, I was in economy, I was in coach on the flight back, and I was instantly angry. was no longer sort of, I felt instantly like, how dare they do this to me? It's terrifying how quickly that seizes you.
Is technology screwing up with our brains? Like, you got a phone, all of a sudden there's an upgrade. You need that upgrade because you don't want to go back to life the way it was with the old phone.
Yeah. So the slight problem is that, like, what phones have done is they've made... I can't work out, was reality always boring and we were just waiting for phones to come along and distract us? Is that what's happened? Or have the phones kind of, you know, mesmerized us and rewired our brains? You drop into a soothing mini coma every time you're fiddling with a phone, basically. It feels like you're doing something and you're not really. I mean, I call it soothing. Often these days you're sort of doom scrolling, which is the opposite of soothing, but then you're locked into that, right? Because you're constantly doing it, hoping for some kind of reassurance, like a frightened animal. Doing Black Mirror, I think often people assume it's sort of written by the Unabomber, that I'm sort of like some anti-tech, do you know what I mean? Like sitting in a log cabin and, like, you know, scowling at... But no, I used to be a video games journalist. I love sort of... Yeah. This would be a terrible job to do if you hated technology. And a lot of these things are miraculous, really miraculous inventions that we've created, and incredibly powerful tools. It's just, you know, they come with unforeseen consequences and they're powerful tools.
Yeah. I never saw Black Mirror as you being anti-tech.
Oh, good.
I mean, I think what Black Mirror is to me is something that what might happen if maybe we allow it to dominate us.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I suppose really in almost all of our episodes, the problems come in when a human is misusing something, or they're not thinking through the consequences of what they're doing, or they're driven by fear, or they're driven by jealousy or weakness. That's usually the problem, whereas the technology itself is a neutral tool. And also in the show, we have to show technology that you would want to use yourself.
Yeah.
That's sort of, for me, the measure of a really good Black Mirror episode is when you can absolutely, as a viewer, see the value of the tech we're showing you, and you'd sort of wish it existed, or you wish you could have it. I mean, you probably will in 10 months' time.
Yeah. One last thing, Charlie. What do you want to come out of Black Mirror? I mean, do you want Black Mirror to maybe change the way we use technology, the way governments regulate it, especially maybe with AI regulation? What would you like to come out if people have a lesson from Black Mirror?
You know, I'm not trying to sort of influence policy. I'm not trying to sort of... I slightly get confused sometimes when people describe the show as a warning about the potential uses of technology. It's more I'm worrying. It's more that it's me worrying in what I hope is an entertaining way. That said, often we're showing cautionary uses of technology, but hopefully there's some optimism also mixed into the casserole as well. Was that an answer, or did I dodge that question?
You did both, I think, Charlie, but that's good enough for me.
Oh, perfect.
Charlie Brooker is the writer and creator of the series Black Mirror. Season 7 is now streaming on Netflix. Charlie, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
This is NPR News.
The punk rock band Blink-182 was as popular as ever when they broke up.
It felt like my world had ended. It felt like I had gotten divorced, like someone had died. It felt like a huge sense of loss.
I'm Juana Summers. In his new book, lead singer Mark Hoppus tells the story of how one of the biggest bands in the world overcame all the small things on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Inflation cooled last month, thanks in part to a sharp drop in gas prices. NPR's Scott Horsley reports egg prices, though, are still climbing just ahead of Easter.
Consumer prices in March were up 2.4% from a year ago. That's a smaller annual increase than forecasters had expected. Prices actually fell slightly between February and March, with gasoline prices dropping nearly 6%. Airline tickets and used cars also got cheaper last month, while new cars and clothing were more expensive. Egg prices continue to climb in March thanks to the lingering effects of avian flu. Stripping out volatile food and energy prices, so-called core inflation over the last 12 months was 2.8%. That's the lowest it's been in 4 years. Although President Trump has suspended many of his new tariffs, he's left some import taxes in place. That could put upward pressure on prices in the months to come. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The European Union has paused its planned tariffs on U.S. goods after President Trump paused some tariffs on Europe and other countries for 90 days. It's for time to allow for negotiations for Europe. But all but one of the member states had voted for the counter tariffs in response to Trump's 25% tariffs on all steel and aluminum prices. Wall Street at the open sharply lower. The Dow is down 1.6%. The Nasdaq is down 2.7%. You're listening to NPR News. From Washington. All of the former research chimpanzees that have been living on an Air Force base in New Mexico have finally arrived at a chimp sanctuary in Louisiana. As NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports, many of these chimps are in their 50s and 60s.
These chimps are so old and frail that the National Institutes of Health had originally said they weren't going to be moved to the federal chimp sanctuary, that the change would be too stressful. Last November, though, the NIH reversed course. Over the last few months, workers carefully transported 21 chimps to their new home, which is called Chimp Haven. Raina Smith is the CEO.
All of those chimps are really doing well, settling in at Chimp Haven and just starting to thrive.
The NIH stopped using chimps for invasive biomedical research a decade ago. Almost all of its chimps, nearly 300, now live at this sanctuary. A small number are still at two facilities in Texas. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
The cost of a stamp could be going up again this summer. The U.S. Postal Service, a financial supporter of NPR, wants to hike the price of a first-class stamp to 78 cents. That's up a nickel from the current price. Postal officials say they need the higher price to achieve financial stability. And on Wall Street, sharply lower today after the historic turnaround yesterday. The Dow is down 707 points, the Nasdaq down 478. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. And from Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19, the CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Asian markets rallied this morning, hours after Wall Street made an historic one-day recovery. The markets turned around dramatically yesterday after President Trump announced a 90-day pause in steep tariffs for countries other than China. President Trump says tariffs are meant to strengthen the U.S. economy long-term, but analysts around the world expressed fears that the volatility could tip the global economy into recession. Among those raising alarms is a former diplomat from Singapore. Our colleague A. Martinez spoke with the former permanent secretary of Singapore's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and that conversation was just before President Trump's tariff reversal.
Slow global growth is not good for Singapore because international trade is 300 times the size of a gross domestic product.
And Bilahari Kausikan says he doesn't think it's good for the U.S. either.
I can't find a single economist, except perhaps those working in the second Trump administration, who thinks that tariffs will have a very positive effect on American growth in the long term. It will lead to inflation. It will lead to perhaps loss of confidence.
Do you understand why President Trump is taking this route? Is this something that, if you look at it somehow with a longer lens, that maybe there is some sense to this?
Well, if I take a very broad view, a long kind of view, right? Why was America very open and generous? I think the fundamental reason was because of the strategic imperatives of the Cold War. You open your markets generously as a strategic tool in the Cold War, in the existential struggle against the Soviet Union. Now, no Soviet Union, why should Americans continue to paraphrase John F. Kennedy, bear any burden, pay any price, fight any foe in order to uphold your vision of international order? I can't think of any.
Now, some analysts would argue that U.S. tariffs could push Southeast Asian countries to shift closer to China, both economically and politically. Do you think that's likely or even possible if these tariffs continue?
No, that's a very, very simplistic way of looking at it. It's condescending and insulting because it assumes that we are all so naive as not, or stupid as not to know our own national interests. And it's simplistic because, you know, China itself is going to be affected by these tariffs. Domestic demand in China is soft. It's not entirely clear that it can raise its domestic demand. It's been trying for more than a decade, don't forget, huh? And it's not had much success. So China is not going to be this great sponge that will absorb everything that we can't sell to America anymore.
Now, President Trump says these tariffs are about bringing manufacturing jobs back to the United States. From your perspective, is that a strategy that could work in the long run?
You know, manufacturing left the United States for a whole variety of reasons. Cheaper costs elsewhere, only being one of them, right? And some manufacturing will certainly shift back to the United States. Many countries have announced quite substantive investments in the United States in the hope of getting relief from the tariffs. But, you know, it's not a question of shifting a plant or two. It's a question of shifting entire ecosystems that have grown up around particular sectors. So even if it's going to work, it's going to take a hell of a long time, and it may not work. It will work at best only partially. People who know the semiconductor industry much, 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 much better than I ever will tell me the U.S. is not ready. You don't have enough skilled semiconductor engineers or engineers of the right type. You don't have enough workers with the right skills. Now, in time, you will build that. You can build that, but that's not going to be done overnight.
Is it possible that if countries wind up getting into bilateral agreements with the United States on certain things, that we'll just have dozens and dozens of these all around the world for specific things and not have maybe a cohesive trade plan?
We haven't had a cohesive trade plan for a long time. The multilateral negotiations to liberalize world trade collapsed a long time ago. So you have got a whole mosaic of bilateral and plurilateral trade agreements among different groups of countries. Basically, the U.S. prefers to deal with countries bilaterally because that's where your leverage is. And Mr. Trump is an extreme example of that.
Bilahari Kausikan is the former permanent secretary of Singapore's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Thank you very much for your insights.
Thank you for talking to me.
The Trump administration's shifting tariff policy has left consumers rattled and uncertain. But as NPR's Scott Newman reports, the price hikes caused by the trade war could linger even after it ends.
Whether or not we're aware of it, we're all a bit too familiar with a basic tenet of economics. Prices go up quickly, but come down slowly, or not at all.
If you look at the trends in prices over a long stretch of history, it's much more common for prices to rise.
That's Kenneth Louie, director of the Economic Research Institute of Erie at Penn State University.
When we have policies like tariffs, that's going to lead to an upward ratcheting of prices if we look at the historical evidence.
Carola Binder, an associate professor at the University of Texas School of Civic Leadership, says this is due in part to something economists call price stickiness. It can be caused by a number of factors, including shifting supply chains and even the cost of changing prices. An example of this, she says, is a restaurant owner printing a new menu to reflect a higher price of guacamole.
If they think that prices of avocados are going to continue rising, then they're going to set prices higher now. And that's because of that price stickiness, because they know that they're not going to just instantly print a new menu like every hour as input prices are changing.
How long the tariffs last is another variable. Philip Braun, a clinical professor of finance at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management, says if they go on long enough, companies will be forced to shift supply chains away from the U.S., causing further disruptions in markets. He says some items, like fuel and other commodities, are less sticky than manufactured goods, but ultimately companies will set whatever price the market will bear. And that could be bad news for consumers. Scott Newman, NPR News, Washington.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com.
This is NPR News.
Many law firms and universities are making deals with President Trump. An expert on authoritarian regimes talks about what she's learned from Hungary. Next time, Here and Now.
Your city, your station, your news. Download the NPR app today, your new home for live radio, local podcasts, and everything you love from NPR.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. Barbie has a new friend and he can hoop. Mattel teamed up with LeBron James's Family Foundation to launch a new Ken doll. It's the first such doll modeled after a male professional athlete. It will be a full inch taller than standard Ken dolls and carry a King James-sized price tag, $75. It features some classic LeBron James touches, headphones, a varsity jacket, and his Family Foundation emblem. LeBron says it's about inspiring kids to dream big. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. A strike by a mental health therapist at Kaiser Permanente in Los Angeles is dragging into its sixth month. This week, eight of them took it to a new level, a hunger strike. NPR's Katie Riddle visited them on the picket line.
One day longer.
One day stronger.
There are dozens of people chanting and protesting outside this Kaiser Permanente medical center on a busy strip of Sunset Boulevard. But a handful of striking workers are conserving their energy, sitting quietly under a tent instead. They're on a five-day hunger strike. Adriana Webb is talking to a nurse who's come by to check on them.
Like, I felt like I was getting a little bit of chills. And I, like, Googled it and said it could be because, like, I'm in ketosis from not eating.
So that it's a little early for that. Okay. But it could be your blood sugar is a little bit low.
Okay.
Nurse David Verdinier is from a different union, not on strike. He's volunteered to do some medical oversight for these strikers.
The bigger thing is that you feel fine today, but, you know, your body's going through withdrawals, right? You're used to eating three meals a day.
These workers have been asking for the same pay and benefits as their colleagues who work in other types of healthcare, as well as more time in between patients. Aida Valdivia is a licensed therapist.
Having to do the hunger strike was a more escalated effort on our part. To let them know that we are serious, especially if we are willing to sacrifice, right?
She says many workers on strike are already sacrificing, draining savings, going to food banks, borrowing money. This is a way of making their suffering more public.
You know, we've had to limit our food anyway, so basically you are kind of starving us, Kaiser.
One of the people out here is Sal Roselli. He's the former president of the National Union of Healthcare Workers. He reads from the sign he's holding.
Same company, same work. Why not same wages, pension, benefits?
Lack of mental health parity is a national issue. One recent report showed people seeking the care of a psychologist, for example, were 10 times more likely to go out of network and pay more. California has passed some parity laws and been celebrated as a leader on mental health. Roselli says it's time for the state's medical institutions to show their commitment to this cause.
This hunger strike demonstration of such absolute commitment to forcing Kaiser to change, it will eventually have a national effect in terms of achieving parity, and the year will come where the term mental health care doesn't exist. It's simply health care.
Kaiser Permanente management is taking notice. Patty Clausen is a vice president for its Southern California region.
Having our employees go on a hunger strike is very disturbing to us.
Clausen argues that Kaiser Permanente does pay their mental health care workers competitively, even if it's not the same wages as some of their colleagues. Clausen says they're eager to keep talking.
We are committed to finding the common ground for all of us.
Back outside the medical center, the strikers have a special guest. After all, this would not be LA without a celebrity appearance.
My name's Tom Morello, and I'm a union man.
And longtime member of the band Rage Against the Machine. He stopped by to cheer on these strikers with a quick concert.
When I say union, you say power, union,
power,
union.
Morello leaves them with this message.
So, it's my belief that the future of the working class in this country will not be decided by Congress. It will not be decided in the courts. It will be decided by the solidarity of people just like you on days just like this. So,
protesting, he says, can work. But it does mean enduring some pain and discomfort, and in this case, hunger. Katie Riddle, NPR News, Los Angeles.
This is NPR News.
La, 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 la.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. The Trump administration has halted a program to upgrade affordable housing across the country. The renovations would have made older places more livable and energy efficient. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports on what the freeze means for people in one small Virginia town.
Linda Morgan loves living at Trinity Woods, a subsidized place for seniors in Emporia, Virginia, near the North Carolina border. But about 3 years ago, the aging central air conditioning sputtered and died.
In the afternoons, it's terribly hot.
She's 67 and shows me how she stays cool during long summers.
This is my portable air that I'm going to hook up this weekend in that window. And this is what you call the swamp cooler that I just put water in.
One in the living room, the other in the bedroom, plus a fan in the kitchen and three more fans where needed. Morgan's a retired nurse and especially worries about the many people here with asthma or other breathing problems.
We've sacrificed so much in our lives already, and to think that we cannot live in a comfortable, safe environment as we're older is just devastating to me.
That's why she and others were thrilled a year ago when Trinity Woods was awarded a $5 million loan to help finance a new HVAC system and other renovations. It was part of a billion-dollar program passed by Congress in 2022. Hundreds of affordable complexes got funding. But now that's been terminated by the cost-cutting team of Elon Musk, according to an internal email seen by NPR. The Department of Housing and Urban Development says the program is ongoing and it's evaluating other options to help communities. It says the Biden administration's energy efficiency crusade does not fit the agency's mission. Either way, money is not flowing. That does not go over well with Trinity Woods residents Dina Moore, Sonia Urquhart, and Lynn Mason. We sit and talk in the community room, which is harder to cool and already feels stuffy and warm, even in spring.
Last year, it was a god-awful. We couldn't stay in here. And we had bingo on Tuesday and Friday nights. We couldn't even play bingo.
It changes your routine, what time you get up. You know, I'm going to lay down when it get cooler. It's just, it's horrible.
I was praying and hoping that everything was going to come along and get renewed. This is home. When I came here, I didn't have nowhere to go.
The head of maintenance, Lester Jenkins, takes me out a side door.
This chiller right there.
The chiller, a large rusty metal box, is the backbone of the building's central air, but a marker shows it was installed in 1993, which is why it now sits silent and still. I asked Jenkins, how many years should a chiller last?
About 20.
So you got good out of it.
You got good out of it, sure did.
I have been pleading for at least 3 years to do something about this air conditioning.
Reverend Richard Bridgeford heads Norfolk Urban Outreach Ministry, which worked with HUD to develop Trinity Woods. As with all affordable housing, he operates on a shoestring and can't just raise rents to cover a major renovation. Plus, this kind of subsidized housing has no equity, so cannot take on debt.
You can't get any funds, any money to fix anything.
HUD's now frozen program provided a way to get that money.
This is how government works at its best.
Julia Gordon was an assistant housing secretary at HUD under the Biden administration. She says if this program were not on hold, it would help more than 30,000 people across 42 states.
It uses government funds to help the parts of private industry that are trying to provide affordable housing in today's housing market. It helps them save so much more money.
Trinity Woods, for example, could save money by switching from expensive propane to cheaper solar panels and heat pumps. To get this upgrade money, properties also have to remain affordable for at least 20 more years. Linda Couch, with the senior services nonprofit Leading Age, says that's crucial with such a severe shortage of low-cost housing.
The first tenet of any housing advocate is to preserve what we have.
There are legal challenges over this funding freeze, and Trinity Woods is searching for other money, though there's a lot of competition and it likely would not be nearly as much. They hope to at least get enough to replace the AC and give the frustrated seniors here some relief. Jennifer Lutton, NPR News, Emporia, Virginia.
Since President Trump took leadership of the Kennedy Center earlier this year, many artists have been trying to figure out how to proceed. Some canceled performances. Some reached out to the Kennedy Center's interim president, Richard Grinnell. NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento has this report.
Guitarist Yasmin Williams has played at the Kennedy Center many times.
I didn't like how so many artists were canceling shows there because I just know so many people who work there and they need the income.
But she's also worried about rollbacks in DEI initiatives. So she emailed President Richard Grinnell asking how President Trump feels about performance cancellations and what changes are being made to hiring and booking practices.
His response to that was, "Let me ask you this question. Would you play for Republicans or would you boycott if Republicans came to your show?"
She and Grinnell continued to email back and forth, but she didn't feel like he answered her questions. He told her she shouldn't believe what's written in, quote, "newspapers who exist to hate Republicans." Musician Kathy Fink, who's been performing at the Kennedy Center since the 1980s, wrote Grinnell in March with similar concerns. She quoted a Washington Post article, and this is how Grinnell responded.
"Can you tell me why you believe the Wash Post? We didn't cancel a single show. You were flat wrong."
NPR reviewed the email threads, and they appear to be legitimate. The Kennedy Center did not respond to NPR's multiple requests for comment. Both Williams and Fink shared Grinnell's responses on social media.
"They're anything but leadership-style correspondences."
Williams says she doesn't think the conversation should have taken a political turn. Fink agrees.
"This is a place where we need to be pulling people together, not dividing them. And it's a place where we need to be having conversations instead of arguments."
Williams and Fink both want to keep performing at the Kennedy Center, but they say they want it to be a venue that is welcoming and accessible to all Americans. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin.
I don't think I should improvise, man. It's not like sitting at home, I can tell you that. It's not like playing at home by yourself.
Well, what can we do for you?